welcome to Fat Camp Show number 33 for sometime around mid-July 2018. Fatbike.com presents Fat Camp, a more or less monthly podcast covering different technical aspects of fat and plus bikes. Look for all our shows at fat-bike.com/radio or subscribe to our feed on iTunes.
All right, some killer tunes from our friend Ken. Welcome to Fat Camp number 33. It has been quite some time, folks.
Yeah, we've been on a little bit of a Fat Camp sabbatical for a while.
Well put. Way more sabbatical than hiatus, I would say.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Definitely.
We had a great interview last month with Y-Cycles.
Yeah. Yep.
Adam was great. And I guess we're going to call that Fat Camp 32. I mean,
I think we did.
I think I talked 2 minutes, maybe. That's okay.
Oh, it was so important, your contributions, yeah, man.
But hey, thanks for the continued emails. Thanks for the messages on the Instagram about where you guys been, blah, blah, blah. We're here. Things get busy and things happen and life happens. And we're like, hey, we forgot to record. Mostly because we've been riding our bikes too much.
Yep, that's a good excuse to end up having. Yeah, I mean, because we kind of kicked it off, North Carolina.
Yeah.
That was in our spring.
Last we spoke was winter.
And we were like getting psyched to go to North Carolina.
Right, exactly. So we both
ended up going to Brevard over our spring break, which is like right at the end of March.
Yep. Wow, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It really was. But it was awesome.
Yeah.
All sorts of, I mean, just great riding down there.
Yep, amazing riding.
Good friends, good riding.
Good food.
Good conditions. It looked like it was going to be like biblical rain before we go.
Right,
and then it ended up being like one of the nicest weather years we've had out of the last three.
Yeah, yeah. So a little bit of rundown on what's going to happen. We're going to talk about that trip just a brief amount. You know how it won't be long.
Yeah, we're short-winded.
We're going to get into North Carolina real quick. We're going to go right back to that. Then we're going to talk about a coast-to-coast, and we're not talking Jersey to California, but we'll get into that. Someone's going to go out to Oregon in less than two weeks probably, and do the Oregon Timber Trail. We're going to talk about that. A little bit of Fork Flex for all you dorks out there, which this is a podcast about technical aspects of fat and plus bikes, so we're definitely going to have some geekitude in there. And then we just got some new stuff that we're going to talk about that's happened since Sea Otter, that's happened since May or since June. We're going to get into that. So it should be a full, regular old, real short,
action-packed
Fat Camp podcast. Remember those tunes you heard at the beginning? Here they are again, ladies and gentlemen, one more time. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back with you. Hey, we're back with some killer tunes again, and we're going to talk real quick about a long time ago, we went to North Carolina, and we figured some things out.
Yeah. No, so going into that, you had an epiphany about kids' bike tires.
Right. I bought my oldest daughter, she's 13, a 26x3, Jameis Eden. We've talked about it before, I think.
I think I'm pretty sure we did.
It's a 26-inch. It's a 26-inch plus bike. So that kid was all set up, but the other kid still was on this 24x2-inch tire.
Yeah, you weren't able to get a bike that would be worthy of like shelling out money for that would fit her.
Right, because she's going to grow into the next
bike.
Yeah,
she's just about to the 26x3.
So what Ken and I were thinking about was like, hey, are there any bigger tires for 24-inch, for kids' bikes, for 24-inch bikes or 20-inch bikes?
And most kids' bikes have amazing amounts of clearance on them because they're designed like, so chain stays will be more similar in length to an adult size bike. You know, it's like so you get these big spacing areas, and there's some good tires starting to become available.
So what he found out was we could score a 24x2.6-inch Kenda slant, which is perfect for a kid's bike.
Yeah.
And it fit with ample clearance.
Yeah, you basically like made the tire about 50% wider.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, it seems like she just absolutely loves it.
The only thing she noticed is how much more fun she was having on it.
Yeah.
Didn't like, and kids aren't like, well, this roll's kind of slow, you know. I noticed the increased mass on my wheel to try to accelerate the bike. all she noticed was that she was having way more fun. And this isn't stuff in DuPont and Pisgah. This is a kid that's just doing some flowy stuff.
Who's only ridden in Michigan pretty much before this. Right. So, you know, new experiences down there as far as the terrain.
Right. So when you go for a mile downhill and she's just laughing at the end, it's because she didn't screw up anything because she had confidence of these 24x2.6 tires.
Yeah, some big fatty tires. The same things that we love about them, kids love about them.
So our unsolicited advice to any person that is listening right now that has kids and kids bikes for their kids is to, hey, go to your local bike shop, see if they can get a fatter tire for that thing in the same wheel.
See if it'll fit.
In the same diameter, yeah.
Yep.
And they'll have way more fun, and you'll have more fun. And if your kids are having more fun, and you're having more fun, then life is
Everybody
good.
Everybody has more fun.
Exactly. Speaking of plus bikes, though, previous trip to North Carolina, I took down a steel rigid hardtail. That's
with
not
the
right.
Bluto.
With a Bluto, right? So it wasn't steel rigid. I took a hardtail down to Pisgah with a Bluto on the front, and it was okay. I consider myself an okay skilled rider, and it just kind of made things sketchy. So this year, I took my 29 plus Salsa Deadwood that I've spoken about on previous podcasts down to Pisgah DuPont and fell in love with it, man. It was amazing. That's the perfect amount of suspension I needed. It was the geometry was perfect for that bike, and we get some emails or messages on Instagram like, hey, talk more about the Salsa Deadwood 29 Plus. I'm a huge fan on my local trails. At my correct local trails, not on flowy stuff, but you know, there's certain trails.
Well, even the flowy stuff, a full suspension bike can be fun.
Right.
And, because the one thing you haven't mentioned is not only is it full suspension, but there's the dropper.
The dropper post. Exactly. So
yeah, the dropper is another key piece of technology you've added to your quiver.
Right. So not only full suspension, dropper post, which is a whole new button to push on the, game controller, you know.
Well, you got to train your mind as far as when it's a good time to use it, and when it's not. So you get efficient that way, and you don't have to think about it. You just ride,
right?
You know, that's a big piece.
I'm still thinking about it though, because I don't ride it enough.
But yeah, and that's the thing. And then the other piece is there's places in the trail where you can kind of leverage it,
right?
You know, because you know it allows you to lean the bike over more. So if you've got you got to get out of the way of a tree, you might be able to get more out of the way because you're able to move the bike more,
right?
Or you're hopping over stuff, so it's like you can kind of pop over stuff a little more easily, and the bike doesn't get in the way, you know. Or it just just so much easier to move on the bike, get low on the bike, you know.
Well, and even this winter, there were times when I wanted a dropper post on my fat bike.
Yeah,
and a good friend of ours, Mike Peterson, shout out to Mike down in Ludington, recently picked up a dropper post for his fat bike that he rides in the summer.
Yep, you got an E13. He and I talked actually for a moment about it beforehand. I'm going to be curious to see how it works for him.
Is that a relatively good post?
It's one of the cheaper options.
Okay.
So check in the right box.
Yep.
It's purely mechanical, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
It doesn't have like an infinite adjust. It's got a couple of presets because it's got like a pin or something that kind of goes in there. So it's got a mechanical closure instead of like a, you know, hydraulic or you know some other type of thing.
Okay.
So very simple. You know.
Yeah, but you either want it up or you want it down, don't you? Basically.
I mean, it can be nice to end up being in one of the middle spots, and it's the thing that's nice about those preset ones is that it's easier to find the middle spots you like on those versus the infinite ones, because the infinite ones, you're just kind of like, okay, I know I'm sort of in the middle and it feels all right, and then I might have to adjust it again. Whereas, you know, you've only got like one or two middle positions on a post like that.
Right.
The other mechanical thing on it is it's not got an air chamber. It's got just a traditional metal spring.
Okay.
So it's a little on the heftier side, but it should have very good cold weather performance. He wants to end up using it year round, which I'm going to be very jealous of.
Right.
And you know, there's no oil to thicken up and get slow. There's no seals to get really hard in the cold and, you know, make them suck. So there's very little to go wrong. I think it hopefully will work real well for him.
Maybe something to think about for, the fat bikers out there that are going to ride in the winter and want a dropper post, because I've wanted one. The other thing that we kind of started a long time ago and continued in North Carolina.
Like maybe a year-ish ago.
Right. Yeah. And are continuing even now. Are
2.6-inch tires.
A study of 2.6-inch tires.
Which we have planted our petard, or whatever the term is for it, in the sand. That 2.6 is in the plus category, not regular mountain bike.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah. I don't really give a crap about the categories. It's just...
What's a platard?
Isn't it one of those... I don't know. It's like... I want to say it was like the...
God, I thought you were making fun of. Like,
I think it's petard, not. But I might be wrong. I don't know. Okay.
Whatever. At least it's not retard. Yeah.
This isn't like vocabulary hour. By
well,
Ken
it just
and
threw
Andy.
Me off. You know? I was like, "What? Whoa!" There's a word I don't know.
So I was saying, 2.6-inch tires are. I still consider them plus tires because traditional tires you can never get this size, and this is totally like a new thing, and I love them.
So So over a year ago, you started riding them.
Yeah, I started riding the Schwalbe Knobby Nick, and then. Earlier this spring I got on a Maxxis Recon 2.6.
Okay.
And then I got a pair of the Vittoria
Mescalinis or Mescalanis or
yeah, I apologize. Yeah, I'm not gonna be able to say the name any
I'll
better.
I'll find out. Keep talking.
Yep. And then most recently I got a pair of the Bontrager XR2s. And what I'm gonna do is I don't wanna talk too much about this other than to say all of them are awesome tires.
This one is replacing like Chupra.
Yeah, the Bontrager XR2 is replacing the Chupacabra. It looks basically the same tread pattern. It's just
Mezcal, Vittoria Mezcal.
Yes, thank you.
M-E-Z-K.
Yep.
Mezcal, let's just put it that way.
So I've been riding these a bunch.
Yeah.
You know, they haven't totally replaced my plus tires. I've been bouncing around a lot, but they're all pretty rad tires, and I've been liking the experience of 2.6. So I'm going to be doing an article in Fat Bike about all that. Hopefully soon, but maybe not because there might be some like logistics that get in the way.
Well, what we're finding out about 2.6-inch tires, and we didn't say this previously, is that they will fit on standard forks, right?
Yeah, yeah. You can squeeze them in a whole bunch of stuff.
So I'm going to put a 2.6 on front of my rigid on my single speed.
Yep.
And I'm going to throw a pair of, I'm going to throw a 2.6 on my wife's bike, which is a RockShox. Reba.
She's got a Reba, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
And there's plenty of clearance on a narrower rim.
Yeah. Yep. And, you know, is your tire shape perfect? No. But it still gives you a little bit bigger footprint to work with.
Right.
You know, so it's like, yeah, the thing's going to fold over and stuff. But it's just, if you got the clearance, it might make sense. You know, gotcha. So it's not drastically different riding than a mountain bike, you know, tire. It gives you all of the characteristics that you like about plus tires and fat bike tires.
I think 2.6-inch tires are like Peter Sagan.
Like what?
Well, he's a good all-arounder.
Ah, yeah.
You know, he can climb, he can sprint, yeah. You know, he can sit in the pack. And it's on a plus tire, but it's on a skinny tire, so it's kind of the in-between kind of thing. It can do it all, exactly. You ran into some good luck with Minions?
Yeah, it surprises me. Like when I'm down in North Carolina, I ran a Minion DHF on the front.
Yep.
And that was, I think, 3-inch. I don't know if I said that or not. But I really enjoyed it. I swapped out for a different tire for a while I was down there and just didn't have nearly as much fun in Pisgah. It's like that big old 3-inch Minion. It's like, it's got great side knobs. It still rolls fairly well. It's a little on the heavy side, but like with all the wet roots and rocks, and then you get into loamy sections, and then you get into, you know, like gravel road type stuff. It's just such a versatile tire. I mean,
so plus tires are still going to be good no matter where you go then.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, there's a time and a place where I wouldn't want to end up running a plus tire. Like if I lived down there year round and I knew all the little secret lines you can pop off of and stuff like that. Okay. And I was spending more time in the air, I probably wouldn't want a 3-inch Minion on the front.
Gotcha.
But not knowing the trails and needing to kind of plow through stuff because I'm just sight reading it.
Sure.
It's a pretty rad way to end up just getting rowdy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really forgiving tire that just did everything right. So I was stoked about that. So when in doubt, run a Minion.
More tire talk from Ken and Andy.
Yeah.
It's kind of like coffee talk with Paul Baldwin. And lastly, something that I have recently thrown into my Camelback permanently, irregardless of season, are tire plugs.
Yep. Good thing to have.
I went with the Genuine Innovations tire plugs, which have the inserter and the cap.
Yeah, it's like a little pill bottle type thing. Right. Yep. You got the quote-unquote bacon, which are the plugs themselves, these sticky, fibery things.
Yeah. Not expensive addition to your wherever you're storing your multi-tool. You know, throw it in there.
Yep.
But there's other options, though, too.
And I think at one point in time, we did a show talking about this and how if you're running tubeless tires, if you get a flat and the sealant doesn't take care of it, the first thing you should be doing is plugging that thing.
We've talked about this.
Yeah, or if, you know, it's really freaking cold and you want to get that thing to seal as fast as possible, you should probably plug it. Just when in doubt, if your sealant isn't seeming like it might work.
Yeah.
And I'm trying out a new system for plugs. Because I've used the Genuine Inflation. It's a great system.
Innovations, not Genuine Inflation.
Oh, yeah. I hope I'm not saying it wrong now.
Anyway, what's the other?
I'm using Dynaplug.
Dynaplug.
Yeah, and they make they've kind of like got an alternative where it's a little bit different than the Genuine Inflations, but most of theirs are kind of pill bottles. But they've got this one. This is the only company I think that's doing this for inflation these plugs. Is they have a CO2 cartridge attached to it.
Huh.
So what I like about this is, you know, normally if you use the Genuine Inflations, you're going to end up plugging the tire and then you're going to open up another hole in the tire and you're going to end up hooking up your CO2. And then you got to get back over to where you plugged it to try to get your sealant, you know, you get down on the bottom where your sealant's going to, you know, basically really now finish the plug job.
Right.
And you can just lose some precious time there. Whereas with these, you know, the Dynaplug one, you can just plug in and you shove the, like kind of the tip, like way deep into your tire, open up the CO2. So you have no hole on the tire.
You never have to take out your valve core.
No, exactly. You have like basically the one hole, you just plugged it and now you're starting to inject air into it. And then as you pull out the inflator, it leaves the plug in the tire. So you're like sitting there right with where the plug is. You can get it down to the bottom so you can get the sealant to, you know, kind of coagulate and, you know, basically fill it all up.
Right.
And you don't have like this, the deal where you have two holes and now you just got to close up one and you got to get to the other one to deal with it.
Based on my experience, it's always been way easier to clog one hole and fill it up and get it to coagulate rather than two holes to get it to coagulate.
Thanks, Andy, for bringing it on home.
Well, I wanted to make sure Gomez was approving of this show.
Yeah,
you know,
so we keep earning our E rating. Sorry, Chad.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Moving on from there. The next reason why we didn't end up recording podcasts for a while would be the coast to coast.
Well, kind of.
Yeah.
Right. Matt Acker of Salsa fame and Grand Rapids, Michigan fame and
the beard.
Regional bearded dude put together a race that went from Lake Huron over to Lake Michigan.
Yeah, so all the way across the mitten.
Gravel roads, forest roads, two tracks, maybe 10% pavement.
Yeah, it's somewhere, 10 to 20% pavement is what my guess was.
And so that was, you had to sign up for that in May.
Yep.
Right? And that took place on a pretty nice weekend in May.
It was an awesome weekend. Right. I was a participant and...
Well, I was getting to that, but you beat me.
I didn't mean to let the cat out of the bag.
Well, I was going to... I was going to try to draw... Since these podcasts are so short, I was going to try to get some more minutes out of them by just drawing it out. So a few locals were like hemming and hawing about signing up for this race. You know, it's in the inaugural gravel grinder across the state of Michigan. And our friend Ken was like, what the hell? I think the week before...
Well,
I had been
hemming and hawing because I hadn't gotten a lot of training miles in. It's like we had a really, really, really late winter.
Right.
So, I mean, literally, it was the weekend I did 2 weeks before the race, I still was riding through patches of snow.
Right.
And it wasn't necessarily on the course. It was like out on doing forest service roads and stuff like that. However, there was still snow 2 weeks before the race.
Right.
And the course didn't open up until I think it was the weekend before the race.
Yeah, because Matt was out there recon and everything going, holy crap, I hope we heat up soon.
No, and the longest ride I'd done before that was like, I don't remember, it was high 80s.
Right.
It wasn't that long a ride.
So this ride was going to be 210 plus.
Yeah, I think it ended up being 216 or something.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the one I did was 216. I think mine was longer than the race. But anyway, 200 plus miles, you know, across the state of Michigan, gravel roads.
The good part, though, is it kind of comes into our area. So it's like it comes into the Manistee National Forest.
Right,
which,
exactly.
You know, was awesome because that's the most difficult part and also the most beautiful part. And I was able to pre-ride it.
So could you give us what kind of bike did you have? What was your bike set up? And then kind of after the, what was your bike set up? How'd the race go?
So,
and, you know,
okay. So let me, just while I'm thinking about it, because I feel like it's worth mentioning. I went into this just being like, I don't even know if I can finish this. This is a really, 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 I've never ridden 200 miles.
Your alternative
before.
Plan was to like bike pack and then just ride to your house.
Yeah, like I'm
going to
have a credit card so I can just stop wherever I want. Right, you know, right. Just, it's like, if right. the shit hits a fan, so be it. I can
ride to my house the next day.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, this is, I can survive out here. There's no problem.
Right.
So.
That was the intention.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I had no idea.
I'm going to go have fun. You know?
Yeah. So I was riding, it's an old 29er Thai mountain bike with a 9er carbon fork.
Okay.
This is back with like a straight 1 1/8 inch steer tube. So it's a pretty old bike. I want to say probably pushing close to 10 years at
that
this point.
That is one of your old bikes, yeah.
Yeah. So it, normally it's my single speed, but then I was like, okay, I did the calculations and make my bottom bracket drop. I don't mean to be too big a dork, but it's like just about perfect. You take your old 29er and you put on... I was running 700 by 44 mil tires.
Okay.
And my bottom bracket was actually like a little bit high compared to modern gravel bikes.
Which is okay for that. Yeah.
Well, but it's especially okay for me because I've got 180 mil crank arms.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, it was like dead on perfect for me.
Sweet.
So, you know, geometry was like really good. It's kind of a pretty fast handling bike. It's like a 71 degree head angle or whatever. So
how'd you do water?
I had a top tube bag with a hydration bladder in it.
Okay.
And then I could fit two bottles in there also.
Okay.
So I can get – I don't want to get into that much detail. I basically – I had enough stuff from the – you know, like when I started, enough energy drink, and I just planned on picking up water. It's like
okay.
At the first checkpoint, I ended up like I rolled in and I was like, I didn't see anybody I knew. So I was like, hey, anybody have any water? And like somebody gave me a gallon of water and I had my bottles already filled up with the powder. So I was able to fill up.
Okay.
I mean, it was like this, that was like my level of preparation.
Okay.
It wasn't until later on that I actually was able to take advantage of aid stations and stuff.
Gotcha.
But the drop bar setup, that was like talking about the bike. I'm using, it's a one by setup. I've still got an old school kind of like Shimano free hub. I don't have an XD driver. Yeah. So I ran like a 1142 or 1140 cassette.
Okay.
Like 11 speed on the rear, like a Sun Race or something.
Okay.
You know, nothing too chichi. Disc brakes, which was, really, really, really nice. It was great setup. Compass tires. I don't remember how to pronounce it, but like the Cycloma Pass or something. It's a 700 by 44.
Okay.
Compass tires, if people don't know about them and they ride gravel and you don't have to worry about the durability of your casing, are the most amazing effing tires in the entire world.
Yes.
They blow my mind. I could go off for an entire podcast just
so
about Compass
Kevin.
Tires. Yeah, and anybody who ends up getting on them tends to end up kind of falling in that convert, you know, evangelist almost category.
Okay.
Because I have seen the light and it is Compass tires.
Gotcha.
For my gravel riding. But moving onward. So I ended up having all that. I had a frame bag. I think I mentioned that. So I had like all my food with me, but
not a full frame bag though.
No, just like the top
tube
portion.
Yeah.
but I made a bunch of rice cakes and my like date walnut like balls or whatever and
homemade Lara bars.
Yeah, it's like I basically had it all sitting on my counter when I left because I was in a rush and then I forgot my wallet.
Oh.
Yeah, so
really.
Yeah, so I basically just, you know, I had to bum my dad drove me across the state and I like, "Hey dad, you know, kind of bump some money
bucks.
Up." Yeah. And picking up like energy bars at the gas station.
right.
So that was just kind of funny, but that all ended up working out great.
Okay.
So
yeah, you went on the bike long enough to get sick of Clif bars.
I did. I hardly ate any.
Jesus
but,
Christ.
So the race went really well. Went out with the lead pack. After the first checkpoint at 50 miles ish, it got whittled down. There's probably 20, 30 of us. And then we just kind of got into this rolling section that was kind of muddy and started to separate out. And fortunately, I dropped my sunglasses because I was trying to switch them like off because it was getting muddy in my face and I couldn't see. So I was trying to like put them on my helmet. And I dropped them. So I got dropped out of the lead pack. And then so I chased for the next 40, 50 miles, the lead pack. And like I would be counting it out. I could see them on these gravel roads. And it'd get down to like 20 seconds. And then you would get to a hilly part where they would go a little faster. And then it would like stretch out to over 2 minutes.
Gotcha.
And then I'd like get back down to like 20 seconds and it'd stretch out. So going into the next aid station in what, Marion?
Marion, yeah.
Yeah. So they were still in the, like, you know, the whatever you want to call it, the aid or whatever, the, you know, in the parking lot when I got there. And I left like basically a minute after them. Okay. They let me catch back on. I rode with them for a little bit, but then it starts getting hilly. And first one guy, and that lead group was down to, I think, 7 people.
Huh.
Might have been maybe 6 people. And I didn't think I was going to be doing this well at all at this point.
Right.
So I was just kind of blown away to end up being able to just like suck wheels and get, you know, up that far, except for when I wasn't sucking wheels and having to like ride on my own for 40 miles.
Sure.
But so then we got into the hills. One guy gets dropped. I get dropped. I just kind of start riding my own race because it's not that far from there until I get to the National Forest.
Well, and you know where you are,
exactly. And I know what I can do in there. It's like there's all sorts of stuff where it just gets technical and fast, and it's like, you know, I was riding aero bars also. Mm-hmm. So I've got the, you know, a baller setup with, it's kind of a neutral handling bike with these big fat tires compared to a lot of other people.
Sure.
And I could just bomb stuff on aero bars or the section like by the Pine River.
Yeah.
It's a two track, but it's like really kind of got these mud pits and roots, and it's got big sand patches. It's like riding technical single track because they're hardly ever both lanes of that two track good.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of times there's just one lane and you got to totally nail it. And so, you know, able to ride that whole thing at full speed, you know, I was not in the aero bars at that point. That's just like full on. I was running called a cow chipper bar. It's halfway between Salsa's really wide drop bar and then a more traditional road bar. So it's like, I don't know. I got out in, you know, the drops, it was a fairly wide position. It was pretty similar to my mountain bike.
Okay.
So, you know, I could basically rail through that stuff, no problem.
Gotcha.
And I'd ridden it a couple times this spring, so I really kind of knew what was coming and where I had to put the efforts in, where I could flow. So just riding all that stuff through National Forest was amazing.
Yeah.
And I caught Scott, who was kind of, Scott Quiring, who was blowing up at that point because he hadn't brought enough water. That was a long stretch.
Yeah.
And it was starting to get pretty hot. I want to say it was like 65 or 67 miles or something like that to the next aid station. So I caught him and he was able to end up sort of, you know, jumping on my wheel. And, you know, we ended up riding in together to the Dublin aid station, which is what, 150 miles ish,
160,
something like that. You know, then ended up leaving there, ended up getting the Salsa, the Che Lounge or whatever.
The Chaise,
thank you. Yeah, I think that's more correct pronunciation. Yeah, which was really cool. That's awesome. A really neat thing that they're doing.
Traveling around the country for all the gravel grinders.
Yeah, yeah.
Getting some sexy pictures on it.
Yeah, it's pretty darn cool. Yeah. Definitely check it out. And then ended up finishing fourth overall.
Finished fourth overall.
Yeah, yeah.
Went into it, forgetting your shit, no wallet.
Like, yeah.
If I don't make it, I'll just ride home. But instead, I'll keep going and get fourth. So
I don't know how the hell that happened. I was on a good day. But
congratulations, man. That's an awesome race.
Thank
man.
You. That's yeah. Sorry ride. To like kind of babble about it. But
no,
it's just,
not at all.
It was an incredibly well-run race
for
something that stretches across a frickin' state. It's like,
yeah,
this is... It was an amazing endeavor just to like kind of like have this course out there.
Right.
You know, so, and they did such a good job. It was a lot of fun.
So what I did, as some of you may have already read at fatbike.com, I just put up an article about it, is I was like, fuck it. I'm going to bike pack that thing and I'm going to take 3 days, which when weather comes in takes 4 days.
Yep.
Which was totally fine.
Totally cool.
And I would highly recommend taking that bikepacking route and definitely going east to west, though.
Yeah, and it's cool because you kind of
go both ways, but
you get the same thing that I got out of doing the race. And yeah. You know, it's like you basically start at sunrise in the race and finish ideally before sunset.
Sure.
And you can dip your tire in, you know, each side, each different lake and stuff like that. And you basically get that entire experience, but you're not kind of under the gun. You know, you're just kind of taking it in.
Yeah. We modified the course just to get to campsites here and there. But, I mean, it was...
There's really good natural campsites, and you got options. Yep. If you want to do 3 days, there's good ones. And yep. If you want to do 4 days, there's good ones.
Yeah. But going east to west gets... You know, your stoke is really high at the beginning of a race, and you forget how flat and kind of square-like grid it is, you know, because by the time you're getting done, you're going through some really good double track.
Yeah, the west side of the state is awesome.
And if you have a good map... You can put in single track once you get to the Udell Hills, you know.
There's a lot of good options that you can mix in there.
So, coast to coast, Michigan coast to coast. I'll put a link up in the show notes about where to go to get information about that. It's also at the article, if you haven't checked it out, on fatbike.com, that I just put up about the three of us bikepacking that trip. Super cool. Plus bikes and fat bikes, highly recommended. I mean, you can do it on gravel, but
there's some definite sand spots.
Way more comfy on a 3-inch tire.
You got to mentally be prepared to hike a bike if you don't have a plus or a fat bike. And even with a plus bike, you might have to.
Yeah. There was one section on the Pine River I had to.
When I was doing the race, there was like two spots where, you know, most people are definitely going to have to hike a bike.
Right. No, I know those two spots.
Yeah.
One I made it, one I didn't. But anyway, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back, talk real briefly about another bikepacking adventure that's going on pretty soon, and then get into some technical stuff. So hang on. Welcome back, campers. Here we are to part 14 of our Fat Camp 33. Ken, what's going on? What are you packing up for? What's on your mind right now?
So I'm in the midst of, I got to have a cardboard box.
I don't think people understand really in the midst of.
So, okay, I'm going to go ride the Oregon Timber Trail. And I have to pack up my, which is a 670-mile, 62% single track route from south to north across Oregon, and it goes through some of the best riding areas in all of Oregon. You know, the big name spots are like Oak Ridge and Bend and stuff like that. So it's really flipping rad.
So how long do you think it's going to take you in not knowing anything right now?
About 15 days.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're going to have you remember when you did the Colorado Trail and we had like a dedicated podcast about Colorado Trail?
Sure we'll have one.
Okay. We're going to have a dedicated Oregon Timber Trail podcast because we got to hear about this.
It's going to be interesting. This is only the second year that it's been around.
What tires are you running?
I think I'm going to run a 2.6 Maxxis Recon on the front and then a 2.6 Spontrager XR2 on the rear.
Gotcha. Full suspension?
Yep. Yep, good. 100 in the rear, 120 in the front.
Okay, so approximately 14 to 16 days.
Yeah, somewhere around there. I got like 18 days that I can work with.
One refueling, two refuelings?
Well, I mean, you can go off course to get stuff, but the most efficient is basically to stop at Oak Ridge, which is pretty much the halfway point, and do a resupply. So that's kind of what I'm going into it thinking.
All right. Water every day, or do you have to go
it depends on which side of the Cascade you're on. The first portion of it starts out above 8,000 feet, which is going to hurt, and then it's really dry. We're on the east side of the whole Cascade range, so I kind of have to go into it. I know my first 3 days ideally will be about 50 miles,
okay,
because day two and day three only real reliable, like decent water sources are about 50 miles apart.
Okay.
So what I want to do is get like my first day in, be at that reliable water source or very close to it. So I can, you know, basically top off all my water, ride all day on that water, be out of water when I get to the next reliable source where I can camp.
Okay.
Repeat the next day.
Right.
Because if I had to end up spending 2 days on one of those sections, that means, okay, now I have to bring enough water to ride whatever, you know, that the 50 miles, plus I have to end up bringing enough water to, you know, cook dinner, eat breakfast, all this extra stuff. So that's a ton more weight and water.
Gotcha.
So that's kind of, I don't think that's too ambitious, you know, as far as the stats go, but that is like supposed to be the most remote and rugged, and it goes through some really cool stuff.
Yeah.
But I won't get into that.
Right. Yeah. So anyways, stay tuned. That's going to be the August, September podcast.
Yeah. So I'm in the midst of packing for that. That was why we kind of
brought that up. Switch gears.
Yeah. And like in 2 days, I have to have everything I need for like about 20 days on the road in a cardboard box, except for what I carry as a carry-on onto the plane.
Right.
So I got to be very organized.
No big deal. No problem. But let's get into the geekitude of...
Fork flex.
Yeah. Jeez, oh, Pete. So what happened with... What's all this fork flex about? Forks flex. Okay.
Yeah, okay. So...
Who cares how much it flexes?
So, okay. Let me talk about origin story for this data.
Okay.
Scott Quiring, friend of mine, you know, custom builder, rad dude. He decided to build an apparatus to test fork stiffness.
Okay.
Because he's been doing, like, to kind of back up a little bit, the classic really good riding rigid fork is what for the last, I don't know, at least 5-10 years or whatever, has been a true temper bladed, you know, sort of hand-built fork.
Okay.
That's kind of been the go-to. And... you know, you look at carbon forks and things like that, and it's like some of them end up being very, very, very stiff. Like the Niner fork, that's one that a lot of people love. I've had one of those. I thought it's awesome. You know, and you kind of, you know, there's kind of this big continuum in there where some of them are very flexy and some of them are really good handling, you know, but still comfortable enough. And there's some of them that are just like going to beat the shit out of you.
Okay.
So Scott kind of wanted to quantify this because he, like the True Temper is no longer making tubes.
Oh.
And... they basically have, like, shut down their bike division. So, mm-hmm. you know, the classic standard for rigid forks that we've had for years is kind of going away. And Scott, I don't know if that was the motivator or what, I never really talked to him about it, but Scott has been building titanium rigid forks recently.
Okay.
And what he does, a bunch of these mathematical calculations about, you know, bending moments and inertias and all this other kind of stuff. And he tries to make his tie forks ride similar to, you know, what those True Temper forks rode like.
Okay. All
so right. He's done now, like he basically built this apparatus to now go from the theoretical to the actual.
Okay.
You know, how do these tie forks ride compared to, you know, the gold standard in a lot of ways for what people consider to be a good rigid fork.
A steel fork, yeah.
Yep. You know, and then he also had a few other forks around, so he ended up just throwing them in this thing and seeing what he would get to end up kind of getting some data.
Okay.
And so, you know, the classic Quiring made, I think it was a 20, all these were exactly the same length from the axle to the crown or very, very, very close.
Okay.
There wasn't any difference in terms of the height of the fork because he's kind of building them all, and all those forks were built for suspension corrected length, 29er. So he did, you know, the Quiring, you know, steel fork, and that, like, he basically hit the, I guess I should describe the apparatus. He has a clamping mechanism where it clamps onto the steer tube, very close to the crown race. So it's going to be a similar flex place as to on what's on your frame. And then a second clamp further up the steer tube. And then he hangs a specified amount of weight off of the end, the axle of the fork. And then he measures how far that fork then deflects, how far it bends down. And that amount of flex is correlated very closely to, let's say, comfort. Or, you know, there's some steel forks that kind of jackhammer you over bumps and they don't track very well.
Mm-hmm.
There's other ones that track a little bit better. Typically, it up to a point and then they get really flexy and then they are kind of bad. But once again, kind of going back to the classic, you know, steel traditional fork, that's what your baseline is. So then he tested his titanium fork and it was like 14% stiffer.
Oh.
So then, you know, so pretty darn close.
Yeah.
You know, not a big difference. And I've been riding one of those
Yeah, we mentioned that before.
Yeah, I had a Borealis carbon fork, which is a pretty flexy fork, and I went to this Thai fork, and I'm just like, oh my God, this thing's amazing. Mm. Really, really, really just like good comfort, but it seems like it's just stiff enough. It's kind of, you know, balances those two factors really well.
Mm-hmm.
So that was 14% stiffer than the classic steel fork. And then he threw in a Niner carbon fork, and this is one of the, I'd kind of describe it as more like the middle years, I think. I don't think this was like one of the most modern RDO ones with a through axle. This was the middle generation with the through axle.
Right.
And that was 34% stiffer than the baseline steel fork.
A third. Yeah.
So, yeah, exactly. So definitely stiffer. Mm-hmm. And then he threw on, he had a Whiskey number 9 carbon fork, which is another fork that'll fit a 29 or plus tire. But he's always felt like this fork is just like beating the shit out of him, basically. Yeah. And that was almost 52% stiffer.
So you don't want a stiff fork.
I mean, you don't want a less stiff fork than a classic steel fork.
Okay.
That handles really well as a rigid fork.
All right.
You know, that's kind of, like I said, that's kind of the gold standard that you kind of want to shoot for. And, you know, the titanium one comes really darn close and has a similar feel to it.
How does a fork, you know, in the winter, does it matter what kind of fork I've got?
Not as much, no.
Okay.
That's where the Borealis fork always felt really good to me in the winter. Okay. That was totally fine because, you know, your surface is vague enough that having a little bit of a vague fork because a flex is no big deal.
Right.
But where I noticed it was like when I went to my 29 plus and I was riding really aggressively, or if I ended up going bike packing, you know, any of these types of things where, you know, it was especially bad with the bike packing. It was like, you know, I'd have to like load up the whole front end and then it'd kind of go sprung and then it would go the right direction. It was really distinctive and it wasn't cool.
So that fork is plays a role in how the bike is tracking.
Oh yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And most of the time, like I said, you know, a flexier fork for a fat bike, no big deal in the winter. But, you know, the more load you put into that front tire, the more that, you know, fork makes a big difference.
Right.
So, you know, if you're really, you know, pushing the envelope, you know, having a little stiffer fork is nice, but still, I don't think anybody's ever said that, you know, your classic steel fork was too flexy in that kind of scenario.
Right.
So, you know, typically what's happening is like you're going over roots and rocks and it's like it's skipping over stuff, so it can't get enough traction to have that make a difference.
Gotcha.
And that's where this balance is so key.
Okay.
So, just, you know, interesting. I guess
interesting data, yeah.
Yeah, you know, the carbon forks across the board were much, much, much stiffer, with exception. I didn't test the Borealis. We didn't throw that in there, so I can't talk about that. But my guess is they would be flexier than the steel fork, and that didn't ride well.
Did those results surprise you at all?
The Niner fork, I thought, would be closer in stiffness to a steel fork, the Thai fork.
Okay.
Because it's a pretty comfortable fork, and I think that's kind of like that natural dampening quality of carbon. But, you know, I'm a huge fan of the Niner carbon fork. I still ride one on my single speed.
Yeah.
It's held up awesome and it rides awesome.
Gotcha.
But then I love, you know, the steel Clyron forks that I've had in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And this Thai fork, just I think that's the best fork I've ever ridden.
Okay.
It's kind of like a tie frame. It's just this magical ride. It's like, it's springy, but it's just stiff enough. And it just, you know, you don't feel like you're getting beaten up, but the bike's never really like doing anything you don't want it to, but it's just got this personality, this, you know, like pop that I just don't feel on some other bikes. And I have no idea. Maybe it's just placebo. I look down and I see Battleship Gray and it makes me happy. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, that might be the case too. But yeah.
Yeah.
Quick break. We'll be right back with we're going to wrap it up with some new stuff. Well, relatively new stuff. Welcome back to the Fat Camp Podcast number 33. Then they're around the corner and it's going to be the winner is new stuff.
The longest podcast in the world here.
Yes. So we got some new stuff. It's not really new, but it's new to us.
It's
worth talking about.
It is, because it's a lot of times it's some stuff that either isn't available or is coming down the pipe, just kind of like worth your while to check out. There's a couple things that are available
on here.
What do you
got, man? What do you got for us?
So, first things first, a big middle finger to the bike industry.
Ooh, he does not do this often.
It looks like there's a bunch of bikes that are being offered with flat mount rear brakes on the frames.
What are flat mount rear brakes?
So, okay. If you look at mountain bike world, there's two standards for disc brakes.
Here we go.
There's the international standards, the IS mounts. Yep. And those are like, you know, two bolts that are like kind of parallel to the axle on the bike.
Okay.
You know, and then what you do is you put an adapter on there and then you connect your brake.
Right.
Then there's post mounts. That's the other standard.
Okay.
And normally, it's like if you're going with sort of the, I don't want to say the recommended, but like the smallest size that they're designed for, like on most mountain bikes, that's a 160 rotor.
Yeah.
You just bolt your brake right to the fork or to the frame.
Okay.
Everything's good. You don't even need an adapter. If you are upsizing the rotor, then you put in like an little adapter and it adds 20 millimeters and
gotcha.
You're good to go.
Okay.
So that's all good.
Yeah.
I like that. You know, I can roll with either standard. They're both good. But then the road people thought that it looked too clunky to go with one of those two standards.
Now, you're being serious here.
I think that's
the road people thought it was ugly.
Pretty much. Yeah, it pretty much comes down to that. Yeah. And I think they might have.
And a roadaholic wouldn't say, no, you're a stoner mountain biker, and that's why you're saying this.
Well, I think they might say a lot of different things about this. Yeah, but I don't want to get into that.
Okay.
But what I'd want to talk to is the engineers who are originally thinking about this and being like projecting 5 years down the road. Okay, where are we headed?
Okay.
And I think what they looked at is like they, you know, instead of having, it's like a post mount one, but instead of having the bolts be far apart, they're very narrow. They're only like, you know, I don't know, an inch and a quarter or inch and a half apart or something instead of being two and a half inches apart. And it looks a lot more sleek. I'll be the first to say.
Okay.
But
that's a roadie thing right there.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing, you know, with the road stuff, you know, having it be more aerodynamics, I can see, you know, I can see an argument for this.
Okay.
But what's going on now is that it's starting to head over into the mountain bike world.
Okay.
So, I feel like personally, this is needless. I mean, I have not ever heard any positive, you know, spelled out in a logical engineering standpoint for this standard to go over into the mountain bike thing.
You don't even have the other argument other than aesthetics.
Okay, so the probably the best argument I've heard is that since the bolts are closer together when they're engineering a carbon frame, they have a smaller section that's kind of compromised because it has to be built up extra. It has to be really stiff for the brake mount.
Okay.
So then you have a, you know, like it's this fraction of an inch more that you can tune to the ride quality versus the rest of the chainstay, which is like, you know, 16, 17 inches long. So, I mean, I think it's kind of bullshit. I mean, the problem with it is that if it was just a different standard, okay, whatever. You know, maybe they want their mountain bikes to be more clean looking like the road bikes. But it's a pain in the ass to adjust. Oh. You know, it's much harder to get those fine adjustments where you might have to move your caliper just a couple millimeters or whatever. Just kind of, you know, for whatever reason, it doesn't want to self-center, blah, blah, blah. Right. You know, it's like you need to just tweak it a little bit. It's kind of a pain in the butt with this direct mount. So, it's a thing. There's a website for it. It's flatmount180.org, blah, blah, blah.
I'll put it in the show notes against my will.
I have not seen any indications of this going into the fat bike world, but I've seen a lot of indications of this going into the traditional mountain bike realm.
Okay.
There's been at least a half a dozen bikes released in the last, you know, 3 months that have had this standard.
Fuck it.
Yeah.
Mule Fit rims. What's going on with some new
Thank
fat? Let's talk about fat bikes.
Yeah.
Stuff,
let's, yeah. This is a happy subject. Sorry. Right. It took me to deep, dark
place.
So
Mule Fit's got something new.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Mule Fit's been kind of a standard, good aluminum option, you know, with good tubeless category capabilities. So the thing though is they're kind of saying like FU Pugsley and asymmetric rear ends, they don't have lacing on both sides anymore.
Oh, okay.
But it's going with a much more structurally efficient design. It's similar to what you see from the DT where you kind of have like the cross type things.
Yep.
So I think, if I remember right, it's supposed to be like 650 grams. So significant weight loss.
Okay.
You know, it should be a really, really solid option. I'm stoked to see some development going on.
Dude,
in
they look
fat
hot, man.
Yeah. I think it's going to be a super, super, super solid aluminum option. Yeah. One of the best out there.
Yeah. So screw you, Pugsley.
Yep. So then another kind of, you know, in a similar spec realm,
right,
is the, I'm going to just pronounce it as Big Sue, but I might be totally saying that wrong.
I went out with a girl named Big Sue one time.
this is from Fat Back. okay. Hopefully it doesn't prompt any other memories for Andy.
Nope. She was hot though. Big, but hot, you know.
But like 78, you know, millimeter internal, tubeless ready. It looks like it should end up being a really, really, really solid option. About 650 grams once again.
Gotcha.
So, you know, those are two. I'm just glad to see fat bikes getting some love, because they haven't got a lot of love in recent years.
Do you think these would be, could I buy one if I was just, you know, Joe Blow?
I think so. Yeah. I mean,
can I get those Big Sues?
And they're supposed to be available in August, but okay. I mean, that was what was being reported back in like March, April, right. May, sometime a long time ago.
All right. Well, Google search will help me out on this one.
Yeah, hopefully they'll be actually, you know, yeah. I'd give them a call up there. They're good people. They'll talk to you and let you know what's up.
Nice. Something that really stoked our brains.
Oh, it stoked my, yeah.
Stoked several things.
Yeah.
Which
like,
we won't go into.
Yeah, we won't even talk about that.
Was the full stash.
From Trek, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, people haven't seen that. I mean, the stash has been out for a long time. That was a super short chainstay, hardtail. That was like a really nice rowdy bike.
29 plus.
Yeah, 29 plus. Yep. Really, really, really sweet bike. Now,
yeah.
Trek ended up doing the same thing to full suspension. And not just like full suspension, but 130 mils
right.
of like full suspension.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Full on suspension.
Yeah. So that, I mean, it's a rowdy bike.
Yeah. I would love to try one of those out.
Yeah, me too. I think that I was very tempted by that.
I think it's a little bit too much for maybe what I need. I mean, my 29 plus full suspension for where I live is adequate, as it was when I traveled southeast, and hopefully when I travel out west. But I mean, if I lived where there was drops and stuff, I'd want more suspension. I think full.
I don't. It,
on a plus bike.
This just looks like a really like okay. So the knock on the Deadwood has been, it's too short of travel. It's too old school geometry.
Right.
You know, it's not rowdy enough.
Right.
And basically, this is rowdy incarnate right here.
Right.
I mean, you still keep the super short chainstays, 130 mils of travel, you know, and, you know, being able to run 29 plus, or, you know, you're not going to drop the bottom bracket too much. You can run 26 inch tires on here and have it be much more quote unquote normal.
26?
The 2.6, I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
My
yeah,
bad.
Okay.
I don't know if I said that wrong.
Holy shit.
2.6 inch tires, 29.
Gotcha. Okay.
So, you know, you've got quite a range of available tires that are really kick ass and would really kind of fit this thing and work well.
Gotcha.
It's only available in aluminum frame, so, you know, it's a little on the portly side, but it still seems like it could be a really, really, really fun bike.
Right.
I would love to bike pack with something like that. You know, like what I'm going to be doing right now.
Yeah.
You know, that would be a really fun bike because, yes. You know, I've already designed into my schedule to drop the bags for a few days and just go play on these incredible trails. And if I had a bike that was, you know, had a little more, you know, sprung to it and stuff like that, it was playful like that kind of bike. Oh, that'd be amazing.
Yeah. Link in the show notes. If you scroll down, you'll see there's some full stash. There's a full stash link to take you right to all the sexy stuff.
It's a hot bike.
Yeah. But some new stuff in the drivetrain. Is XTR going 12 now?
Yes. And in general, there's a lot of cool stuff. And it's like, we're going to start off with XTR, which is a Chi-Chi option. Kind of blow through that because there's a ton of press on that.
Okay.
But there's a lot of other cool stuff in the drivetrain world for fat bikers and plus bikers. So the new XTR, it is 12 speed. They one-upped SRAM. Instead of having a, you know, a 10 by 50, which is what Eagle is, they have a 10 by 51.
All the dentists will like this.
Yeah, they've done a lot of cool stuff like that. The thing is, I don't want to disparage XTR because there's been just some incredible engineering. I think there's, you know, there's some really cool stuff coming down the pipe for people who can afford stuff other than XTR.
Right.
But it's a couple years off And that's an option that's out there. Okay. But for more reasonable options, there's the Garbrook. I don't know how you pronounce it.
I'm going to go with you.
Yeah, but so it's a 10 by 50 wide range, 11-speed cassette. This is kind of like the E13 11-speed cassette that goes, right. I don't know, what is it, 9, is it 42?
I can check real quick.
It's, yeah, it, basically, it's another one of those things that kind of provides a similar range to Eagle. This does the same, but it's an 11-speed cassette.
946.
Okay, yeah. And that, if I remember right, that's like 100 or 511%.
Holy shit, 946?
Yeah. Yeah, so wow. So the high end, you have a little bit more high end, so you can still run like a 30 tooth and chainring instead of like a 32 or 34 something like that. So you get the high end, but then, a lot of your derailleurs like a Shimano XT or whatever, like normal 11 speed can fit that range.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's that.
When will it end?
Oh, who knows? Jeez. But this Garbrook is cool because it's 1050. It's 11 speed. So you can just throw it on your regular old, SRAM type stuff, one by system, 11 speed. And the reason why I feel like this is kind of fat bike specific is because, I mean, I don't know about other people, but for me, like when I'm riding on more buffed out trails or roads or gravel roads or stuff like that, when there's big jumps in between gears, it's a little bit annoying.
Right.
But when I'm fat biking, I mean, the conditions are so variable. Sometimes I'm just like grinding it out at like, 50, cadence. And then sometimes I'm like spinning and really high. And it's like, I just don't seem to notice big jumps between my gears nearly as much.
Sure.
And typical snow fat bike conditions. So, if you're going the same range as a 12 speed, but you only have 11 speeds, you're not really giving up anything if you don't notice the jumps. That's what the one negative is. And it's fairly light, so it's not like it's this boat anchor thing. Some of the Sunrace ones are kind of on the hefty side and stuff. So that doesn't have that negative. It's got a lot of positives. It's just you got big jumps between gears.
Good for E13.
Well, we haven't even talked about the E13.
Well, I thought you were talking about the 10 to 42 thing.
Well, E13's got it too. Like you're talking about the 946, but then E13 just released another thing, which converts your 11-speed drivetrain to a 12-speed. If you've got a SRAM Eagle, or excuse me, you've got a SRAM like XX type setup. Yeah.
Oh.
So what it does is it replaces part of your shifter.
Okay.
Because you look at SRAM, they've got a whole bunch of 11-speed stuff. They got NX, they got GX, they got
XXO,
and then XX1.
Right.
Yeah, so, they've got a full, kind of continuum of really kick-butt 11-speed stuff out there. And what this E13, conversion thing does is it gives you a different part to your shifter.
Okay.
You put it in there, now all of a sudden you got 12 clicks in your shifter.
Really?
Yeah. And they've got then the rear cassette that they also sell with it that's got 12 spots, or you could run an Eagle cassette if you wanted to, or you can run whatever the hell you want.
No.
But like this kit, it's a little on the pricey side. I want to say it's like right around $300.
Ooh.
But,
ooh.
If you have to replace your cassette anyways, this could be a really easy way to upgrade to 12 speed without having to upgrade, shifters and cranks and a whole bunch of other stuff. It's just, it's just basically a little internal part on your shifter and then the rear cassette. So once again, it's another way we had talked about in the past. I was surprised fat bikes weren't getting a lot of love as far as component selection. So starting to look at new models and things like that. And it's like, and they didn't have Eagle. These are different ways to kind of get that same range that Eagle provides, which if you're running a one by on a fat bike, I mean, I think that big range, that 500% ish range is super key.
You think E13 is thinking that maybe there's going to be one by 13 someday? I mean, do you see a 13, a 14, a 15 gear? I mean, on a bike?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure we'll have it.
Really?
Yeah. I'd be amazed if we, I mean, I thought going from 5-speed to 6-speed was crazy. So it's like, now that we're twice that, it's
okay.
Yeah. I mean, it just keeps on marching.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. That kind of blows me away because I was like, I remember I was never going to give up my 8-speed.
Yep.
Jeez, oh, Pete. All right. Yep. Okay.
The march of progress here.
Right.
Modernity.
Right. Anything else new that you want to talk about before we wrap this up?
Just kind of a
I just said wrap this up. Wrap this up.
Thank you for Pete. Yeah.
Good Lord.
Pronouncing better.
Well, someone would say he just said wrap it up. He doesn't know what the fuck
he's
talking about.
Quark. Tire pressure gauges.
What Quark tire pressure
gauges? Yeah, so Quark is a company that they started off as like an independent power meter thing.
Okay.
They built a really quality power meter, and they developed it very quickly and had a very good kind of feedback loop, I guess is how I describe it. I've read enough about the company to know that like they basically responded to customer feedback and, you know, like professional rider feedback and a lot of these types of things to develop their product really fast and make a really good like quality power meter.
Okay.
And it was so good, SRAM bought them up.
All right.
So now it's a division of SRAM. And Quark has now started to spin off several other products. One of which was the ShockWiz. I love the ShockWiz.
Airtime.
Yeah, I've got one. Yeah, I love that stat. But it's, for instance, you know, the ShockWiz, the reason why it's such an awesome device is like you really only use it to kind of dial in your suspension once.
Yeah.
Per se. And then you're good, but it's once for like kind of where the, you know, like kind of the terrain you're riding. If I was riding really, you know, like jumpy, aggressive machine built in one spot, or I'm riding really chunky, you know, natural in a different spot, I'm going to have probably different suspension settings. So it can be good for setting up those different suspension settings. Where it's really good is bike packing. And now all of a sudden I'm going to strap 20, 30 pounds on my bike.
Right.
And now I got to be like, I've got one little ride I can fit in here before I have to pack my bike up and ship it off and like hopefully not have to pack a shock pump.
Sure.
I just want it to work.
Right.
So what I'm going to do, I'm going to go out with the ShockWiz. I'm going to collect a bunch of data and I'm going to end up going off the recommendations and tweak it in to where it needs to go.
Okay. All right.
Hopefully that's a pretty fast and efficient process. And then hopefully, you know, my bike handles really well. And every other time in the past, the ShockWiz has been awesome.
Quark.
Yes. So, no, just this company
Quark
is deserving
does the same
to
thing.
Talk about. Yeah, so this is a weird product from a really cool company.
There you go.
The tire pressure gauges.
Okay.
It's like I want to say $200 for these things.
Ooh.
You get, you know, one per tire. It, you know, basically records your tire pressure to your cell phone and does a whole bunch of stuff, which
sure.
seems really, really, really dumb. To me, like it's just like so over the top. $200 to measure tire pressure just seems silly. I will buy like a little like manual thing,
analog.
Yeah,
you know, yeah.
But all of that said, you know, it's like I can kind of like my knee jerk initial reaction is this is stupid. This is too much money to spend on it. I think this is going to lead to something good because if you look at like if this thing can accurately measure to even a half of a PSI for fat bike type stuff, that, I mean, that could end up being pretty significant to help you out as far as like dialing in. You know, that's one of the biggest issues we see on our trails is people running the wrong tire pressure out there. And if there was an easy way for, you know, shops to send people out and just be like, run this.
Yep.
Run this.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it's like if there was a way to demystify the fat bike tire pressure thing, this could be amazing.
I see what you're saying. Okay. I didn't know where you were going, but yeah.
It took me a little while because it's, I just,
really?
Yeah, I kind of just recoil from, you know, the dorkitude of this. And if you look at it on face value, it looks like some like stupid Kickstarter type idea that somebody had or whatever. But I know what the ShockWiz does. And I think that this, you know, TireWiz thing could do the same.
And SRAM invested in it, so you know it's got to be something, you know, that worthwhile.
Well, I think they give Quark, you know, that division of their company, a fair amount of leeway to kind of follow their bliss.
Gotcha. Okay.
So, you know, it's like I think what they did was they were like, we got these electronics for the ShockWiz. Now let's do another air pressure-based thing.
Oh.
You know, and,
okay.
You know, kind of adapt it to a different direction.
Can you put ShockWiz on your front fork, too?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Do you need, if you have a top and a bottom, do you have to have two of them then? Duh.
If you're going to record at the same time, but what you could end up doing is like what I've done is just run it on the rear, collect my data and be like, oh, okay, I want to make these tweaks. And then I go out, ride again. And then, you know, I still have it on the rear and like, oh, okay, I got it now. So then you can switch it over to the front, collect your data, and be what like, oh.
And if it's dual, then you got to do it again on the bottom.
Oh, no, 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 no. I'm sorry. If you're talking like dual air, single air, yeah. all that kind of stuff, no. You can just use the shockwaves on that, and it's okay, good, right. period. Gotcha. Yeah, because those are different shocks where the two chambers equalize, and it can handle that.
Yeah. And that, my folks, my friends, is called Fat Camp 33. An abrupt... Jeez, oh, Pete. No.
Gotta shut me up.
No, not at all. We've been on hiatus. No, what was it? What'd you call it? It
wasn't sabbatical.
Hiatus. Sabbatical, yeah. We were on sabbatical because we were doing research. Don't forget our email. We should have mentioned this like an hour ago. It's at fatcamppodcasters.
Plural.
At gmail.com. Also,
we've gotten a lot of good emails, and we've responded to a lot of those emails. And yeah. at some point, we probably should just integrate into talking about those emails.
Right.
Because I think other people might enjoy it. But
usually I forward them to Ken.
Yeah.
Some of you might get the pleasure of hearing right from me, but it'll be like for an easy question. And also, we're on the Instagram at Fat Camp Podcasters. That, of course, it's plural as well. So we post up once in a while. Ken, you need to take more pictures, dude, because we need more.
I plan on taking lots of pictures when I'm out west.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Can you get those to me through your spot?
Not through the spot, but I should have cell signal now and then that I can send it out.
All right.
So I will try to be good about that.
We're going to try to liven up the Instagram here with, by God, by no means will be daily pics. Trust me. You're lucky to get a monthly pic of something's dumb. Anyway. I do want to thank, and I know Ken does too, maybe he will personally, people who listen and people who...
that have endured our absence.
Endured our absence. And, you know, since I think it was 2015 we started this gig and we're still rolling.
Yeah, 3 years. That's kind of amazing.
Gomez still is like, all right, whenever you guys, although I'm sure you'd like it more regularly. But anyways, that's number 33. Check out the show notes. Check out the pictures. Check out the Instagram. Shoot us an email. And we will see you on episode 34 in August. Peace out.
Thank you for listening. The music we are using on today's show is from the Free Music Archive by The Pickups, and it's their song, Ride. You can find all our shows at fatbike.com, including notes for today's show.